famed author Clive Cussler.
The hero, Dirk Pitt.
He's a courteous bastard. The giant, nearly 6 feet four. What in hell are you doing in my bedroom? Critical damage to your vital parts.
Iceberg. Episode 1. Dam Bung Twister.
Also, swans are everywhere. Swans have taken over my town. I didn't make the papers. Goats made the papers. Swans are fucking everywhere. Where did they come from? They're huge. I don't know anything about them, but they've taken over the town. They're in the town square. They're in the playgrounds. They're mean. They're very, very large.
Now's the time to find out if swans are edible.
I hear they're very tasty. I'd eat one. Would you?
I hear so much about geese. Like, we're used to geese up here in Canada. We're drowning in geese. But the only time I ever hear about swans, is there any chance you've ever heard of a TV show called Slings and Arrows?
No.
The main character, played by Paul Gross, who most people know from being on Due South, before the show starts, his backstory is he's an actor. He's a Shakespearean actor who has a nervous breakdown, stumbles off stage into a decorative pond where he strangled a swan. And this swan strangling comes up over and over in the story. And he's like, I already apologized about that. And it's just a great visual of him throttling a swan.
At the top or at the base?
I think it's funnier if it's in the middle, because then you get the cartoon wobble effect on it.
Oh, okay. Where would it be most effective, though?
Hopefully the top, because then it's not beaking your eyes out.
Oh, yeah. Then you can use it as a lasso.
Swing a swan around your head 3 times. And now we're back to Mazel Tov.
Yes, and there's a dance that goes with that, traditionally. I know in England, all the swans are owned by the monarch. So it would have been the queen. Now they've got a king over there.
It's one of those situations. You're hunting the king's swan.
Yes. But have you had a goose? Have you eaten goose? Geese, if you've had more than one.
I think we had like a roast goose one time when I was a kid. I've had duck more often than I've had goose.
Yeah, duck is fantastic. The duck is such a tasty animal. It's very unfortunate for them. Peking duck is pretty awesome.
Oh, so I said earlier, I have a surprise for this episode.
Okay. What is it?
So let's see if the camera will pick this up.
The Adventure of Vin Fizz. Oh my goodness. 349.
Clive Cussler wrote a children's book.
That's a children's book. Wow.
Yeah. So this is like a large text chapter book. So this was intended to be like a kid's first chapter book.
Oh.
It's two kids who meet a magical Middle Eastern man who gives them some sort of device. I'm not entirely... Oh, it's an enchanted box that turns toys into full-sized real versions of it. So they make a full-sized version of the Wright Flyer and fly across the country having adventures with a dog.
That could have taken a turn once they meet a mysterious... I'm glad that's... I love it. That's very...
I am delighted for this. Like, and the spine is perfect. I don't think it's been read. This is like a mint condition, whatever the hell this book is. You can barely find it online even.
That's amazing.
So he wrote this.
How'd you find
it? He wrote this. It flew below the radar. I was just at the bookstore, and I was the local bookstore here, Books and Company, has a huge and growing section for like anything on the table, $2. So it says $3.49. It was actually $2.
Oh, okay.
I'm always hunting through looking for mostly horror novels, but 90% of them are Westerns and Star Trek The Next Generation episode novelizations.
Okay.
But occasionally you find something amazing like this.
Well, it reminds me of Edgar Allan Poe wrote The Tamerlane, which nobody's read. And it was rejected by his publisher when he first wrote it. So he hand-bound like a few copies. And some lady in a New England bookstore saw one for sale, like you, for $2 and bought it and then sold at auction for, I don't know, a kajillion.
On the flip side, there's a book I've been trying to track down for 2 years now. Have you ever heard of Sometime Never?
With a title like that, possibly?
It's a very obscure book. It was written by Roald Dahl. It was one of his first and only adult books. You wouldn't say it holds the record, but it holds the title of being the first book written about nuclear war.
Oh.
And it's about humans go to war with gremlins that live beneath the surface. Nuclear bombs get deployed. And in the end, the only thing left living on the planet is one worm, which pokes its head out and shrugs and goes back underground. That is a bleak-ass book, and I'm trying to find a copy of it. And the cheapest one I've found is $600.
Oh my God.
Because there was one printing and it didn't sell. But this book sounds bizarre and amazing. And he wrote it after fighting in World War II and hearing about the nuclear bomb.
What year was it? Let me see.
1948. Sometime Never, A Fable for Superman. Met with mostly negative reviews.
Aw. Talking about read piles, I have two. I don't think you'll pick it up with my camera here. I've gotten two of... I haven't gotten very far in Iceberg because both copies that I've gotten, they're demarginalized.
It runs off the page?
It runs off the page. It starts too close to the binding.
Wow.
Two books. I ordered one from Barnes & Noble and one from Amazon.
You are sinking far too much money into this podcast. I'm very sorry.
I just sent you $1 for half your children's book. I don't know if you got the ping. I was hoping you'd get the ping and then laugh.
Oh my God, you sent me $1.29 from the... I suppose we should start season two.
Oh, season two? We're season two? Okay. Season two.
I mean, if we just call this season two, then we'll be one of the first podcasts to get through 50 seasons.
You're a genius.
Think of the distinction. So, season two, episode one, Welcome to Cussler Hustlers.
Hello, everyone. This time we're doing the book Iceberg by Clive Cussler. I am Nancy, and that is Topper.
All right, so except for missing every eighth word, how far did you get in Iceberg so far?
I've gotten through lining it up with the other book, and I've got another one coming. I've got through the prologue and the first chapter.
Do I have to lead you through chapter two and three then, or?
Yeah, you'll have to lead through chapter two and three. It's just not, I know it's surprising, it was to me, that this isn't on the bookshelves of my supermarket.
Not this one. This one's from 1975. You have to go to thrift stores and flea markets.
Yes, and big budget retailers that apparently have never looked at their product line.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, that should really be at the bottom of a box full of remainders or something.
Yeah, nobody's looking at them.
Or maybe it's worth more because it's a valuable misprint.
Oh, sure. It's like money.
Yeah. You're slowly acquiring a collection of rare and valuable Clive Cussler novels.
I know that the world is bigger than the U.S., but the U.S. had come out with a dollar. It was golden and called the Sacagawea dollar.
I've heard of that.
It was in an effort to give more people of color and women representation and money. And it was the first dollar coin to be minted in a long time. And I was working in New York City. I got off the subway train and there were people with these golden dollars trying to hand them out. And everybody, including myself, just walked right past them like, you weirdos, what are you doing? I'm not falling for this.
This must be some kind of scam.
It was a Treasury Department stunt to get them back into circulation when they were first put out. So it was actually people giving away money in New York City. And the story was like nobody would take it. They all thought it was some kind of scam.
You truly are the land of plenty. People will just turn down free money in America. Someday I'll move there.
No, you won't. Don't do that.
No, I won't.
Enjoy your healthcare and your infrastructure. Let us battle the swans versus the geese. You will know when we come to the episode title, because it is in chapter one, and I wonder if you thought when you read it that would be the episode title when we get there. But we start with the prologue. They're setting the scene. A plane is slowly circling an iceberg.
That's the name of the book.
Yes, just Iceberg. I thought it was Iceberg exclamation point. Just Iceberg, in case you listeners need to insert that into your personal Dewey decimal system.
I think we have to wait for Night Probe to get exclamation points.
That sounds vaguely like a threat. I felt that Clive was really feeling himself here. There's this sentence, slowly the iceberg grew larger in two circular walled tunnels of the binoculars. And I thought that was like, you see, only in the prologue, circular walled tunnels. I've never thought of binoculars that way. That is indeed what they are. They're circular. They're tunnels. You could have a square tunnel, I suppose. But it was rather poetic. And I was like, oh, he's having fun right off the bat here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the writing is in a lot of ways better in this book already, like going through the first couple of chapters here. I especially like the bit at the end of chapter one plot-wise. We'll get to that in a second. But that was the first time I thought, he's done some practice. He's gotten notes from his previous one. And it actually occurred to me, this is something that I think is very common with a lot of writers, where you'll be working on something for weeks or months or occasionally years, and you've been staring at it so long, you can't tell what works and what doesn't. You've gotten feedback from beta readers and they're like, no, it's great, send it out. And it's only when it's sent out, when it's published, when it's online, when it's with the editor, when it's with the printer, when it's out of your hands, that's when you figure out what you should have changed.
Oh,
only when it's too late.
That's got to be every writer's nightmare at all times. The aircraft is circling the iceberg and they see something. It's confusing. They don't know what it is. They go closer and they see the outline of a ship's hull in the iceberg. And some guy is like, oh, we should mark where this is. They drop a mayonnaise jar. No, a pickle jar off the side. It's got a bunch of red dye in it, which doesn't seem like nearly enough, but I guess in a sea of white, in a field of white, a dollop of red will do you. And it marks the iceberg so our hero can go back in the first chapter and attack the iceberg.
When the plane throws the jar and then flies off, there's a long pause, and then two men wearing white snowsuits stand up on the iceberg and pull out a radio and send out a message.
Yes.
So right away, you know there's villainy afoot.
There's baddies that are abounding. And I can just imagine the antenna. So they wait until the aircraft flies away. Okay, you and me, fellow baddie, we have to get our signal out. But it's early 70s, late 60s. Let's get this antenna extended. You extend and you extend and you extend. And there's
that big handkerchiefs, hoop on the end.
handkerchiefs. You pull out somebody's boxer shorts and a brassiere. And then finally the antenna is all the way up. Now we could send the signal.
And we bust into chapter one, introduced to Lieutenant Commander Lee Kosky with a corncob pipe. And he's short. He's not just short. He's very short. They describe him as short two more times. But basically as wide as he is short. He's basically a cube. And a lot of sensual description of his hair. Very proud of his hair. I believe you mentioned on the previous few episodes how Cussler really goes into the hair descriptions.
He does love hair.
But this is Lee Kosky of the Catawba, one of the Coast Guard's most advanced North Atlantic patrol boats.
Clive lived in a time of really sensual shampoo ads. Like, when he was writing this, he would see a Prel commercial that would light your hair on fire. Well,
70s hair was amazing.
Oh, it's all people had. They were just made of... It was pre-corn syrup in the food distribution. So people were just skinny with hair. Lots of hair.
And that's where all the CFCs and the hole in the ozone layer came from, was just hair product.
Yeah, hair product and spray deodorant. And we meet some new characters. The first thing that we meet is the Catawba. It does have a landing platform on it.
And that's how we meet the hero of our story.
Judas Priest. No. It's Dirk Pitt. He's in this one again.
Everyone's watching because there's no way a helicopter can land on a boat being tossed in the middle of a North Atlantic storm. But the helicopter does some Fast and the Furious shit and somehow lands on the boat.
And they didn't even have to go to the moon for that. Like the Fast and the Furious.
Well, this is 1975, so this is like Fast and the Furious -6.
Somehow The Rock will get residuals off of this. But he went, it was very descriptive. The swells of the ocean, the coldness of the water, how bracing it was on the skin of the men outside. It was not bad. Good for him.
The ocean as a character has a lot more to do in Iceberg. In Mediterranean Caper, it was just the Mediterranean. It was nice. It was sunny. The waters were blue. There were no storms. There were no especially big waves. It was just, there's the water. It's nice. In this book, the water is actively trying to kill everybody all the time.
Is there one called Mediterranean Tsunami? Because that would be awesome.
No, I believe that would be book 4, Pacific Vortex. Oh, okay. The book that was so bad, it didn't get published yet. Man, I can't wait for that one.
This guy was amazing. He just kept pumping it out.
One per year, at least for forever.
Fantastic. Good for him. And also, the helicopter that Dirk Pitt rides in on is named the Ulysses. And there's a friend I only see every 10 or 15 years. His name is Ulysses. I lose track of him. And then I find him in the oddest spaces. Like, I worked with him in Manhattan. And then I heard him on a podcast about parenting. He has no children. I heard him on a podcast about parenting that takes place in California. I reached out to him, like I texted him, like, hey, was that you? Was that really you? He's like, oh yeah, that's really me. And then like a train crash in Virginia. He was like, oh yeah, he made the local news. And I was like, was that you again? Every once in a while, this cat Ulysses, who's really nice and very sweet, just pops up out of nowhere. And everybody in the world who knows him is like, hey, it's that guy that we all happen to know.
He really sounds like main character material.
He can be, but he's so nice, polite, and just regular guy. You know, he reminds me of from It's a Wonderful Life, like that main character, like truly earnest. And I hope wherever he is, he's doing a great job.
Your money's in Bell's house. I don't know his name.
I don't either. I've only ever seen it like in bits and pieces. I gather he's a nice man in that movie.
Anyway, the helicopter spits out Dirk. And you think it's going to be Al. I thought it was going to be Al. I had Al written in my notes before finding out that it was actually Dr. Honeywell, not Al.
Spelled unlike the thermostats.
And we're going to be with Dr. Honeywell for a couple chapters here. And he's described as round-faced and kind of mad scientist-y.
And he's overweight.
Yes.
That's important for him because he's got to maneuver around this ship and it's cramped quarters.
And the first thing he does is hand Koski a note saying that the Catawba has to change course and immediately intercept a specific iceberg. So right away, we're on the chase.
They are telling, Koski and Dover. Dirk makes up this grand Russian plot of they had this lost Novgorod. This lost ship.
Yeah, this super advanced Soviet spy cruiser complete with all of their surveillance codes.
In all hands, the vessel in all hands are missing, so they must find this ship.
Mm-hmm.
When the crew of the ship is out of reach, Dr. Honeywell, again, not spelled like the thermostat, is impressed with Dirk's ability to spin that yarn. Because that's all made up. So we leave chapter one knowing that the Novgorod lost ship tale is just a tale.
Yeah, they're in Dirk's cabin. Honeywell says Dirk is great at lying, and Dirk says Honeywell is great at faking messages, because at some point they faked a message from the Coast Guard telling Koski to do whatever Dirk and Honeywell say. So right at the end of chapter one, we realize that there's no Russian spy boat and they just hijacked a Coast Guard boat because they need fuel.
So you think that's what, like a class one misdemeanor?
Yeah, probably.
A fine, some community service?
But yeah, this is a good setup. Like this is, I want to say, a good mystery setup because we've already like, we think we've established what the stakes of the book are. And then we're like, no, we just made that shit up.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Like Dirk has gone rogue after one book.
He went rogue in his heart. In the womb. The chapter ends with Dirk thinking, what would his commander Sandecker call this? And he would call it a damn bung twister.
That sounds like him. Sandecker is like this equal parts like down home and folksy, but also like this tiny, angry politician type of guy. So it's a damn bung twister. You just kind of hear him chomping on a cigar and saying something like that.
Oh, like Patton, George C. Scott.
Yes. It's very that kind of military mind.
There's this retrospective on sex and porn in American culture. And there's this George C. Scott film where he's watching a pornography with his daughter in it. And he's crying because he's in the porno theater and he sees his daughter. And it's the George C. Scott from Patton. And he's still very Patton-y. To see him cry is like, oh, that's sad. And he's got to go out and kill the pornographers. You're like, well, why would you sit there and watch the whole movie?
Context is important.
I nominate Damn Bung Twister to be the title of this episode.
Ah, dang. I was leaning towards when Dirk says cloak and dagger shit, but Damn Bung Twister is amazing.
I like cloak and dagger shit.
No, I'm with you. Bung Twister it is.
Oh, so now we're in uncharted territory. Haha, nautical pun.
I do have notes in chapter two about Lieutenant Dover, who is the other person we meet. And we have to have Dover here because Lieutenant Koski is very short. Dover is a giant, and they're constantly making jokes about how Dover navigates on this ship bouncing around the North Atlantic when he's so big and his quarters are so small. And get it? Big guy? Tiny boat? Yeah.
Juxtaposition.
Dirk Pitt has two and a half kinds of people. You've got the huge guy, you've got the tiny guy, and then you have, I guess, the fat guy.
It's like when someone makes up a crime. Who mugged you, lady? Who stole your wallet with your paycheck in it? But you know she lost at the casino. Oh, it was a tall guy and a short guy. One had a beard. One didn't have a beard. One had glasses. One didn't have glasses. A brunette, a redhead, and a blonde.
I like the flip side of that. Have you ever listened to the Magnus Archives?
No. Don't know that one.
Long story short, horror podcast. There's two recurring characters who are basically a delivery men for Eldritch abominations from beyond our dimension. And one is described as not being tall and one is described as not being short. And that's all you get.
I love that. That's brilliant.
So I still have a weird mental image of a tall one and a short one, but I just don't know which is which.
It's like Doctor Who, the TARDIS. It's either bigger on the inside or smaller on the outside.
Yeah. Right off the bat, we find out after Dirk's had his nap, because he's super exhausted. Dirk spends all of these books exhausted the whole time, and he starts off chapter one achingly tired.
But he can never get into full restful sleep because he's just, his body does not allow it. He's hypervigilant.
They describe how a week before this, he was on a rooftop in California with a nymphomaniac redhead. So I think that's when he was rested.
Oh.
Now they've just ruined his life.
That didn't sound restful.
Yeah.
Active. Nice. Not restful. Tess from season one, she was a brunette. So I guess she didn't make it to the off season. Post-season, Tess didn't happen.
Not Tess, Terry.
Terry, oh.
Yeah, either one.
Lady number one. Does she even have a name, really?
Mediterranean caper female character.
Broad dame number one. Didn't make it to the in-between the books.
In Iceberg, we find out that Koski is not a complete moron, so he sent some messages to DC to double-check their stupid story. Already, we have a competent person in the military in this book, which beats the last book.
That's something.
And Dirk thinks that they're about to get arrested. They get the message from Koski that says, you know, we got this message from the Admiral of the Coast Guard that says to do whatever you say. And that's when Dirk realizes that Sandecker pulled a lot of strings in Washington to get their stupid plan authorized.
It makes you wonder about how plausible it would be, because people do go to their jobs every day and there's fatigue and boredom. If you just rely on that, how far can you get? You show up with your clipboard and your yellow vest. I was sent here.
As we learned it in Beverly Hills Cop, you can get pretty damn far.
Timely reference.
Oh, it was a thing happening right now on Twitter, which was, what was a movie you watched as a child that was absolutely not a children's movie? And I must have seen Beverly Hills Cop 20 times before the age of 10. That was one of the few movies we had on VHS, so I would just watch it over and over. And I had no idea what was going on half the time. I just thought it was the funniest thing ever.
Well, that's a great movie.
And there's a lot of shooting.
For me, it was Pretty Woman with Julia Roberts.
Ah.
I had friends that weren't allowed to see Ghostbusters who were allowed to see Pretty Woman. And it's about a hooker. And she opens, like in the opening scene, she drops all the condoms out of her boot because she has thigh-high boots. And we were like, what are condoms? Do they have to come in purple and blue? Like, we had no idea what we were watching.
Excellent. That's the best time to watch these movies.
And we saw it a bazillion times.
It wasn't until years later when I was watching Beverly Hills Cop as a teen and I realized that they spend like a solid 10 minutes in a strip club. I was like, my parents let me watch this every Saturday. Like, ah, he's too young. He won't remember.
It makes kids say interesting things out of context. It's the joy of parenting. It's when your kid tells on you, dad's been drinking in the car, because they know part of the thing that adults do. Like, drinking and driving is bad, but you could be drinking water and your kid's like, oh my God, mom or dad is drinking in the back.
If we start talking about shit my kids say, this will be a 3-hour episode, so we should probably get back to the book.
Oh, back to the book.
Anyway, they've successfully conned Koski.
And we'll never know if an actual U.S. Coast Guard captain would double check his paperwork. I'm opening my, like, I have notes. I didn't get to chapter 2. There's no notes, but I keep turning it.
Are you going to write down notes while I talk now?
No, I don't think there'll be a test.
So not much happens in chapter 2. Chapter 2 is a lot of scene setting. Dirk and Honeywell get into the helicopter again, the Ulysses, now that it's refueled, and they head off. And Honeywell has, like, since he is the best oceanographer Numa has, and he is like the world's foremost expert in icebergs, he has tracked the exact location of this iceberg. But after 4 hours of flying, they can't find it. They thought they found one earlier, but there was no red dye on it. Honeywell is so mad that his mapping is off, like, he can't believe it. He's the smartest person in the world. How could they be off so far? It's impossible for an iceberg to be out of the currents, because the currents are in charge of everything. And they're about to give up, and they finally find an iceberg with red dye on it that absolutely should not be there, because it's 100 miles off course. So again, in chapter 2, now I'm thinking, okay, this is cool. There's an iceberg that's moving against the ocean currents. This is kind of sweet.
Is the hidden boat driving the iceberg?
No.
Wait, don't ruin it for me. It's
got to be aliens. Oh, no. Like, I want to get through the end of chapter 3, because chapter 3 sets up basically most of the rest of the book. So right when they're about to buzz this iceberg, Dirk changes course and heads back for the Catawba, because there's a Russian submarine a few miles away from this iceberg with the red dye. But then Dirk changes course again.
But the ship is Russian, so it's going very fast. I'll just leave that right there.
Dirk heads back again, and they land on the iceberg, hoping that they can investigate before the Russians show up, because they figured they got like 15 minutes before the Russians actually get to the iceberg.
Because they were rushing.
Okay. I was just
letting, had to underline that.
I was just letting that one go. And chapter 3 is broken into two parts. The first part goes by pretty fast, and we find out that this is the wrong iceberg. There's no boat in it. If a passing airplane could see that there was a boat fused in the iceberg, how come walking around on the iceberg, they can't find a boat? And Dirk is completely unconcerned, because right away, he's got gut knowledge. He knows exactly what happened. So he hangs around on the iceberg and, like, waves at the Russians as they park the submarine, inflate a dinghy, and drive over and land on the iceberg and start charging up it with automatic weapons. Dirk's just like, hey, and waves at them and casually get back on the helicopter and fly off. And Honeywell's like, no, this can't be it. This was the iceberg. This had the red dye. This has to be it. Dirk's like, no, it was the one we saw hours ago that was in the exact right location, but somebody scraped the dye off.
You can't beat an omniscient Dirk Pitt. That's what we've learned. Yes.
They fly back to that iceberg, and unlike the first one that was like nice and sunny and covered in snow, this one is dark, distorted, misty, haunted, alien, unreal, and spooky.
Oh, was it also unnerving and unsettling?
And now there's a boat very clearly visible in this one. The whole iceberg smells like burnt garbage, and they find that all the dye was chipped out by hand. There's footsteps all over the iceberg, so like, a lot of people have spent a lot of time on this mystery iceberg.
Okay. But how big is it if we wanted to put a condo there, if there's a housing crisis everywhere? What kind of real estate are we talking about?
I don't know, because it does have a 150-foot ship jammed into it.
Yeah, you get a six-month rental out of that easy. Well, I'm just feeling very silly right now. The iceberg has enveloped the ship. We don't know what or why. And Dirk has godly knowledge and the gut hunch. He's trusting his gut over all else. And Al hasn't made an appearance yet.
No.
Oh, poor Al.
There's a lot more that happens in this chapter, so I think maybe we'll stop it here, because I want you to read them exploring the ship, because they hit like bang, 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 bang. They hit a lot of plot points in about 10 pages here.
I cannot wait for a copy of the book. It doesn't give me a migraine. It should be arriving shortly.
No, that's right. We are Cussler Hustlers, the podcast that hurts your brain.
Intentionally.
Yes.
And we're not sorry. Good night, everyone.
Unless you pay us to stop.
I'll take payments to hurt you privately. DM me, people. All right.
This has been Cussler Hustlers. Your hosts have been Topper and Nancy. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at Cussler Hustlers.